in the context of the building of the Mishkan, the sanctuary in the desert, which later translates itself into the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, is the problem of sacrifices. The question, and the problem really for us to understand, what is the meaning of killing animals in sacrifice? Not an easy area at all. So let's see if we can begin to get a bit of a more Jewish handle maybe on this subject. And I think the way to do it is to expand the discussion into the question of eating altogether and vegetarianism from a Jewish point of view, eating meat, what that means, the killing of animals, what animals mean, a spiritual level. A big discussion here. Interesting subject. Not sure we can cover all of it by any means, but let's begin at least to, let's try to start working it out maybe. If we manage to do this well, we'll be able to have at least a beginning, just a beginning perhaps, of insight into this difficult area of animal sacrifice, what we call korbanos, derived from the root meaning to bring close, or to come close. But I hope we'll get an understanding of a lot more besides in the area of food, eating, and many related issues. Each element here, of course, needs, each element needs deep discussion. I mean, just the very status of animals themselves. Maybe we could start with that. Animals themselves. There's a fundamental question, really, is why are there animals in the world? Why does the world have animals? Again, why does the world have animals? Why does it have plants, for that matter? But why does it have animals? You think the world has animals because a few million years ago, when you yourself were an orangutan, you know, bumping into each other in the trees, you know, and then that's how you came to be who you are. Right? So of course there have to be animals, otherwise you wouldn't be here, because you're a developed orangutan, or an elevated chimpanzee, or a degraded chimpanzee. I don't know exactly what your level is, but the point is that if you think that way, then in fact you are a monkey, because that's not the Jewish view. We did not arise. Actually, the truth is we did arise in the animal world. The Midrash says that the human being, the human body, is a composite of all of the world. Right? So there's no question we are derived from the animal world. But it's got nothing to do with evolution in that sense. But again, why are there animals in the world? Our deepest sources say that before the sin, before Adam sinned, animals were on a level that we are on now. Before the sin, animals were on a level that we are now. You could have an intelligent relationship with an animal. Adam, of course, was much higher. He was much higher, way beyond any ability we have to conceive. But animals then were on a level that humans are now. In fact, one interesting source is that not only were they on a higher level, but humans were able to relate to them in a completely different way. We know that Adam married all the animals. Right? Are you aware of that? Are you aware of that? No? When it says that he was given Eve to marry as a woman, and he had he engaged in that intimacy of bonding into oneness with her, right, when she was brought to him in marriage, the Torah says, "Zois hapam etzem atzamai ubasom ipsoi." This time it is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. So the obvious question in the verse is, what do you mean this time? Well, what other marriage, which other women did he know before? And of course the Midrash explains, "Zois hapam" means in this marriage, I feel that this partner is of me, of my flesh. But there were others before, and they were with animals. Before he was given a mate, and he saw the animals consorting in pairs, so he understood that there was a completion of his own existence that was needed, and in order to fulfill that, he attempted an intimacy, a bond with each animal, the female of each species, and discovered that none of them were a completion of his own being. And then Hashem gave him a woman who was a female of his own being, and then in that union he felt that he understood that this was a reclaiming of the oneness that he had experienced before he was brought to the world as half of a being. If you ask why it was necessary to engage the animals in that relationship before being brought his wife, the answer is because it's a long and and deep subject, but briefly, is that you can only relate to something in the world when you failed before. You can only build where you can only experience a togetherness when you've been lonely before. Yeah, you can only build a oneness in marriage when you appreciate what it means to be separate. It's only because man and woman were one being in the spiritual world and torn apart to exist as each a half that has lost its other half, right? That the togetherness of marriage can be appreciated. And therefore, he had to go through what is not the right connection in order to understand what is. That's a deep subject. But the point is that animals were then on a level where... And of course, it's for that reason that animals were not allowed to be eaten. There was no eating of animals, right? The human beings were completely vegetarian. They were only allowed to eat plant material. Even after the sin, even after the expulsion from the garden, humans were only allowed to eat non-animals. Yeah, you couldn't eat an animal. Killing an animal remains a very serious thing. Very serious. Killing an animal, the Torah says, Kidam Shofar, it's called spilling blood. To kill an animal for no reason, and even to eat an animal, if it's not done properly, is very serious business. It's not at all simple. The Gemara says only a wise person should eat meat. Not a simple thing at all. But, of course, before the flood, humans were not allowed to eat meat at all. It was considered killing. Only after the flood, as a descent into that post-flood generation, when the world had already been perverted, and animals themselves had been perverted, and humans and animals had been destroyed in the flood. So then after the flood, humans were allowed, there was a concession made to a lower level of human being who is now allowed to eat meat, which still needs tremendous explanation, because humans sinned and the world became perverted. How is therefore the correction or the consequence that we now kill and eat animals? That needs tremendous explanation. Let's begin, if we can begin this evening at least trying to understand what this means. Why animals are the level that they are, why they cannot speak, whereas humans can, why animals have a vestige of human awareness. Yeah, animals have a vestige of human awareness. On the contrary, the Gemara says that prophecy now in the post-prophetic era lives only in children, insane people, and dogs. Maral says not only dogs, animals. Animals have they can be sensitive to certain things, certain wavelengths, they can be sensitive to certain things that we don't see. It could be. But dogs chosen in particular, because dogs have got some unique characteristics. Which again, it's not directly our subject. What's unique about a dog is that a dog thinks he's a person. That's what's unique about a dog. Dogs give them the opportunity. They think they genuinely believe that they're your personal friend. Right? The only lower consciousness than that is human beings who think dogs are genuinely their friends. But it doesn't matter. The point is that the Gemara says dogs have an unusual degree of chutzpah. It's a unique thing. Like each creature is a unique creature. A donkey is a unique creature. Donkey's most... Chamor in Hebrew is the same word as chomer, which means material. The donkey is the animal that's most identified with. That's, of course, why it says that Avram Avinu rode a donkey. And what does it mean that a tzaddik rides a white donkey? That the Mashiach will come on a white donkey? What does that mean? What does it mean? Yeah, he doesn't want to buy a ticket on a thing. What does it mean? The concept is that riding on a white donkey means conquering the purified dimension of matter. That's what it means. The tzaddik, the Mashiach, riding on a donkey means conquest of the material world. That's what a chamor is. It's chomer. Donkey is all material. It's all the earthiness of the material world. Tzaddik conquers that. He rides that. Right? And an evil person, for example, Bilam. So Bilam was intimately married to his donkey, right? You notice the Torah uses a female word there for donkey, for tzaddikim, like Avraham Avinu talks about it. A male donkey, but when it comes to him, he was intimately associated with his donkey. What it means is, of course, apart from the fallen level of, from the impurity of that, apart from that, that's the low, but the deep meaning is not being able to separate himself. That means he's so invested in the material world, right, that it's an intimate part of his own being. He's not riding it as a vehicle in total conquest. Yeah, he's married to it. That's what it means. He has a relationship with his donkey. His donkey speaks to him. Yeah, his donkey. His donkey, his wife. But that is the... So each animal has its own uniqueness. But the animal world in general... Now after the flood, that we're not allowed to eat animals and they fall into that level, Nevertheless, they still have some unique characteristics, and one that comes to mind, again, this is not directly connected with the question of eating, but just to mention, is that animals have, you know, there's a wonderful brisa called Perek Shira. Are you familiar with this? Perek Shira, yes? No? Lively crowd, huh? Perek Shira is an ancient source that goes through, it means the section of song. It goes through the song that every animal, actually every part of the creation sings. There's some wonderful commentaries on this, actually, and even one or two books in English, if you're Hebrew is not good, which gives you the verse from the Torah that each part of the creation sings. That song means, what does it mean that an animal sings? Each bird, each animal, each part of the world, a serpent, and each part of the world, dogs, they each sing something. They each sing an aspect of Torah. What does that mean? A song always means the sign of the completion of a task or a cycle. That means that each animal in the world, each part of the world, is manifesting its perfection. That means it does, of course, every animal does exactly what it's supposed to do. Right? That's obvious. The whole universe always does exactly what it's supposed to do. There's only one thing in the universe that doesn't do what it's supposed to do, and that's you. You and me. Me sometimes. But the point is that the only creature that does not do what it's supposed to do is the human being. Every cockroach and every cat and every planet and every galaxy is always doing exactly what it's supposed to do. And therefore it sings its song. That's what it means. You can only sing your song when your life is over and you've reached your shlemus, your completion and your perfection. Right? The world will only sing its ultimate tenth song when the Mashiach comes. Shir, the Hebrew word shir, meaning a song, also means a circle that's closed. Shir in Hebrew means a ring. Behemah yotzes b'shir shalai, no, a ring. It means the completion of a cycle or a circle where the thing reaches back to its moment of definition, which is its point of origin. Everything in the world sings its song, means expresses its essence with perfection. And Perek Shira tells you what song each animal and each part of the world sings. So from studying that, you can understand the essence of each animal. It's a remarkable thing, an incredible thing to go through. It's printed in many Sidurim, you can find it quite easily. What do wild animals, each animal sings a song. Each animal sings a song, means expresses its essence. So there it says in Perek Shira that Chayot Habar, which we translate in English as wild animals, sing a unique song. The song they sing is Hatov Vahamativ. So amazing thing to understand. Hatov Vahamativ, that means they praise Hashem who is good and does good. There's two levels to Hashem's goodness, right? One is goodness, for example, He feeds you. And mativ means that the food tastes good as well. So not only you get sustained, but there's a pleasure in that which is necessary too. Tov mativ. We make that blessing at certain times. I mean, if you're drinking wine, and you make a brocha, a blessing on the wine, and then you brought better wine, you make a tov mativ. Right? And the birth of a child under certain circumstances. But the classic place where we make that blessing, a tov mativ, is in the benching, you know, in the blessing after meals, after bread, correct? The fourth blessing, right, of the benching, we making atov ha-meitiv. The four brachot of the grace after meals, the first of them is hazanes hakol, the one who sustains, feeds, not the world, and that is because the Torah says v'achalta v'savata uverachta, you should eat, be satisfied, and bless. So when Moses was given that commandment, he composed the brocha of Hazan et Hakol, right? Then it says, Al ha'aretz atova Hashem, on the good land, he couldn't do that because he wasn't in Israel yet. So later when they went into the land of Israel, Yoshua made up the second bracha, Al ha'aretz v'lamazon, right? The third was made by King Solomon, Shlomo Melech, on Bonei Barachim of Yerushalayim, building of Jerusalem, because he did that. And the fourth blessing was added by the sages later. The fourth blessing was added at the time. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks. The fourth blessing was added at the time of the destruction of Beitar. Right? So listen carefully. When the city of Beitar was destroyed by the Romans, a massive tragedy, an enormous amount of people were killed as a tremendous massacre that occurred after the destruction of the temple, of the second temple, the people of Beitar were destroyed. And then a miracle occurred. And they were all not, their bodies did not disintegrate, and they were all brought to burial. Right? Miraculously, although the Jews couldn't bury them because they're lying in the field, none of the bodies decayed, decomposed, and they were all brought to burial. A tov v'ameitiv, those two things. Now the question is, listen carefully, amazing thing. There are different interpretations, but I'm giving you one from a very, very great source, an amazing source. What is the meaning of wild animals who sing Hatov Vameitiv? Again, stay with me very carefully. If the meaning of the brocha, the meaning of the brocha is that brocha which is composed at the juncture in history, which is the miracle of dead bodies that miraculously do not decompose and then are brought to burial, what on earth does that have to do with wild animal song? Yeah, you hear the. But there's an amazing secret here. The wild animals, chayot habar, okay? Bar in Hebrew means outside. We're talking about wild animals. By definition, those that have no human husbandry. No, they're not fenced in any way. They do not depend in any way on human. Yeah, birds would be the best example. Even major game today, right, is in some way constrained. There's no, even in the massive game parks in Central Africa and Southern Africa, there are still degrees of constraint. Probably the last frontier, really, today is maybe the polar ice caps, maybe where the animals, or maybe the biggest of the game parks, possibly. But probably, the oceans and the skies, really. There you have animals which have really got nothing to do with humans. They don't depend on humans in any way, except humans interfere with them. Yeah, another problem. But those are called chayot habar, animals of the wild. They have a special relationship with Hashem. Listen carefully, it's an amazing thing. That wild animals, the uniqueness of their creation is that when they die, their death is not witnessed and they are brought to burial. Again, listen carefully, because what I'm going to share with you is as close to a miracle as you'll ever see. And if this doesn't sensitize you, there's absolutely no hope for you. Wild animals, Hashem deals with in such a way that we are prevented from seeing their deaths and decomposition. Do you understand what this means? Let me ask you something. When last did you see a pigeon, die? When last? I'm not talking about one that got hurt or hit by a car or injured by human beings. I'm talking about an elderly pigeon that reached its sort of sage old age sitting in a tree. And one morning, as you walked out to the Neitz Minyan and Shacharis, it kind of plopped up. Again. Why did you never see that? Listen carefully. It's an amazing thing. Why did you never see that? Incidentally, did you ever hear of anybody who did? Did you ever hear of anybody who heard of anybody who heard of anybody who saw an old eagle kind of topple off its perch, sort of grey, in the... Ever hear? Did you ever see a snake slither slower and slower and expire? Do you know that nobody sees that? Do you know that nobody sees it and no one even reports having seen anybody who ever saw such a thing? Let's just think this through for a moment. There are some species of animal that fly, for example, by the hundreds of thousands. Some species of bird, for example, right? And we know where they fly, you know that. Some birds migrate 8,000 miles twice a year from one climate to another. We know where their breeding grounds are and we know where they fly to and where they go back to, right? And they've been watched carefully. And nobody sees them die? Again, you're talking about 100,000 birds in a flock. They're not all eaten by your cat in the back garden. They're not, right? They die someplace. And they live short lifespans, some of these creatures. They got to die someplace. Somebody should have seen it. Some sailor on a ship, taking a 5-minute break on deck, should have seen a flock of one or two fall into the sea. One or two get a bit too old to keep flapping and sit on the deck and... Why don't you see that? Sparrows, finches, why didn't one of them ever fall on your head? They don't all get eaten by cats when you're not looking. What happens to this little sparrow? Let's just think it through. He gets at some point too old to fly. So what's he doing? He holds onto the branch until he kind of loses it. And then why did you ever see that? And on the contrary, why didn't you see them lying around? Do you know some biologists have done calculations? Do you think I'm fooling you? No, some biologists have done calculations on how many dead insects, rats, mice there should be. We should be walking on a carpet of them. Do you know how many rats and mice there are? The cities should be covered in a layer. Again, you have to understand this. Did you ever see a fly die? Why were you never sitting in the garden sort of musing when you saw it going bzzz? Why did you never see that? Mosquitoes only live for a few hours. There's a remarkable thing here. Do you know that in large game, with large game, the rangers will tell you that they never see them die. In fact, there are many legends about an elephant's graveyard. They go off someplace and they're not seen. Do you know that? The same is true of whales. The same is true of elephants. Big game. What happens to the big game? In fact, very often, what the predators eat the young, the calves and the young that can't run. And occasionally, they eat the old ones too. Sometimes you see a kill. But they don't all get... Yeah, there are places where there are far more, let's say, buck and impala than the predators can... Some of them get old somewhere, no? And even if you didn't see them die, you should see them dead. It's a remarkable thing. The world is running away where the wild animals, not animals that are husbanded by humans. Yeah, your pet dog and cat and cow, etc., they certainly die on you. They depend on you. They're not chayot habar. They're not his responsibility. They're yours. But the ones that are his responsibility that humans have nothing to do with, it's a remarkable feature of the biological world. Some biologists have actually researched this issue and they're completely perplexed by it. That's a very interesting thing. This is a remarkable demonstration. And we're not claiming that they disappear into thin air. I'm not claiming that. But something happens to them. They have an instinct, or they're dealt with in a certain way. That it's not... Yeah, they don't lie around decomposing. Not in the wild, and not in the city streets, and not in your garden. Very interesting thing. Now... And I'm not talking about the ones that people hurt or that get poisoned by human activities and so forth, right? Or get killed. I'm talking about... That is Atova Metiv. So animals, there are some remarkable features about the animal world. But the question of eating animals, right, needs thought. That needs thought. Sacrifices that were offered by animals being killed and burned before the sin... Before the sin, let alone before the flood, what does that mean? How can the death of an animal possibly be positive spiritually? What does that mean? What does death altogether mean? Especially before there was a sin in the world that introduced it. What does all this mean? So let's backtrack, take a few steps back, and see if we can work our way at least to some extent through this area. First of all, let's talk about eating, and then hopefully we'll get to meat and animals and so forth. First of all, eating. Let's ask a fundamental question. Why do we eat? Why were you created with the need to eat? Again, you could have been created just osmosing, you know. Why do you have to take in energy altogether? You see that the world is created in such a way that eating is a necessary part of life. And the meaning of eating, I have to study this carefully, the meaning of eating, you have to ask fundamental questions in Jewish life. You don't take things for granted because the world accidentally happens to be that way. Good, now let's look at... You have to go to the root of things and understand them. The concept of eating is the concept of an external energy that is absorbed into the being for a particular reason. Yeah? The word lechem in Hebrew, which means bread, is the root of the word milchama, which means war. The essence of war in the sense of milchama means to engulf and absorb, right? Another entity. The Aramaic word for bread and the Hebrew word for a battle, also similar. Many similarities here. But the weapons in Hebrew also, weapons, and a kiss, neshek in Hebrew. See, the mouth has functions beyond eating and they're all connected. Let's try and work it out. Eating means that you take in a substance and an energy into your own being, and the purpose of that is to keep your soul in your body, to keep guf and neshama together. Again, the uniqueness of human life is that the soul is investing itself in the body. That's the definition of life. Life does not mean that you have a soul. Yeah, your soul can never die. The soul is not alive as opposed to being dead. Your neshama can never die. The only thing that can happen is it can be combined with your body or it can be distracted and separated from your body. Life, the definition of chaim, the definition of life, is the neshama being put in the body. Death is when the neshama doesn't change, but it moves out of its vessel or its vehicle. So it's a tremendously different state and can't express itself. When the neshama doesn't have a body, it cannot express itself in any way. It has no vessel. It has no vehicle. No kli. No means of expression. But it's the same neshama, the same soul. Life is when the soul is in the body. Death is when it's out. putting the soul into the body takes energy, costs work. The reason is that these two magnetically repel each other with a tremendous force. Again, the body is the opposite of the soul, right? The body could not be more opposite than the neshama. These are two forces that magnetically repel each other. The neshama is a spiritual entity, comes from a source of infinity and purity. The body is a heavy, earthy, contaminated being, contains its own excrement, is given to decomposition as part of the physical world. These are completely opposite beings. Not only that, but on a higher note, the soul, the neshama, is an aspect of infinity. It's a projection of an infinite source. The body is the definition of a finite vessel. The essential difference between soul and body, or between spirit and matter in general, is that in the world of the material, any material thing has a set of dimensions. Once it's brought down, condensed, or crystallized in the physical world, it cannot change. Once it has physical reality, it has a set of dimensions that bind it. The spiritual entity does not have a set of dimensions. The spiritual world is multipotential. The word ruach in Hebrew means moving. It means moving. And the nefesh, that part of the soul that makes contact with the body, means coming to rest. Vayinafash means it comes to rest, right? Because that's where it makes contact with the bottom level, as it were. But that's why, of course, it happens in the liver, the lowest part of the three major organs. And that's why the Hebrew word for liver means heavy. Right? The Hebrew word kaved, liver, means heavy. Right? And of course, that's why in English they call it the liver, because that's where the life force is invested. Right? That's where it comes from. That's where they... Even English has a rare spiritual connection. But the body is the opposite of the soul. The neshama is a projection of infinity. And the body is a finite being. You can't put those two together. You're talking about the ultimate spiritual contradiction. And there are many midrashim that express this in much more... The neshama doesn't want to get born. Why? Because she rejects the neshama from... which is a princess. Your neshama is like a princess from a royal court. And she's banished. The Chafetz Chaim, many midrashim say, Dubna Magid, that the neshama doesn't want to be born. Tries not to be born, refuses, cries when it comes time for its birth. Why? Because it wants to stay in the rarefied spiritual atmosphere of perfection, close to bonded with and part of Hashem. Who would want to leave that and come into a smelly body, into a finite, earthy, contaminated body? On the contrary, one of the sources says that when the neshama comes to be born, Hashem says, I'm going to put you into a human body, and she starts crying. So Hashem says, look, he said, I don't want to leave you. The neshama says, I want to stay with you. Hashem says, look, I'll tell you what, I'll make a compromise with you. I'll put you in a human body for 1 second, and then you can choose. So the neshama agrees. So Hashem puts the neshama into the human body, and she says, don't kill me! And that's how you get born, right? But she doesn't want to go in, because there's the opposite reality. Many midrashim, one famous marshal is that the neshama in the body is like a princess married to a peasant. She's like a very, very royal and dignified, refined creature that somehow got married to a very earthy, heavy, coarse peasant, right? And that's the marriage. That's your body and your neshama. The peasant doesn't understand who he's married to, right? He understands this unreal spiritual woman, this tremendously... So he tries to make her happy. How does he make her happy? He brings her a smelly salami, you know. He thinks that maybe... So the message is the body tries to make you, your neshama, happy by trying to give it physical and sensual pleasures. So maybe it works for an hour or a day, but then again your soul, your inner being, is not satisfied, needs something more, something higher. That's the meaning. But your body can't understand that. Your body doesn't understand spirituality unless you're a tzaddik, unless you worked on yourself, unless you elevated your physicality. But otherwise your physical doesn't understand the spirit. So in order to get out of your depression or your existential tension, so you try to satisfy the body with sensual and pleasurable, and they work for a time. They work for a time, but always that inner drive is telling you. But there's a tension. There's a tension between... How do you keep these two things locked together so that they don't explode apart? Given the opportunity, they would violently explode. The Gemara says that when Hashem appeared at Sinai, when God appeared to the Jews at Mount Sinai, as He spoke the first of the Ten Commandments, they all died. Everybody died. They had to be resuscitated, revived, brought back to Sinai to hear the second of the commandments. When Hashem spoke again, they exploded again. You know what that means? That when the neshama is faced with a vision of Hashem, it doesn't stay around in your body. When it sees its source, the power, the magnetic power of a witnessing, of having experience, of seeing the source of reality, Hashem, which is its perfect soulmate, its perfect, it explodes out of the body with a tremendous force, and the body blasted back 12 miles, it says, outside there. And they had to be recombined and resuscitated, revived. And they were brought back again. When Hashem spoke again, the souls exploded towards him. That's the natural status of it. And after the second time, they said to Moshe Rabbeinu, it's enough. You tell us the rest. Yeah, and you heard the rest of the commandments from him. It takes tremendous energy to hold these opposite forces together. And that energy is called food. Food keeps you alive. Alive means your neshama in your body. That doesn't happen. If you stop eating, then your soul, your neshama, starts to distract itself. You get faint. And if you don't eat for long enough, it snaps out entirely. That's the purpose of food. Again, food is the connector. Food is the energy that the body needs to keep alive. Alive means to keep the neshama in the body. Are we together? You see it in many ways. Let me try and give you one other aspect. You eat with your mouth. The mouth is the organ of connecting worlds. The mouth has three functions. Eating, speaking, and kissing. Those are the three natural functions of the mouth. They are all functions of connection. I mean, the question you have to ask yourself is, why do you have more than one function with one organ? Why are you built in such a way that you have one part of your body that does more than one thing? The Gemara says, actually, there was a question of creating man with more than one mouth. The Gemara says he does enough damage with one. So, it was created. But the depth here is that if one organ does more than one function, the meaning is that those functions must be connected. Can you see that? Because they vested in the same location in the spiritual world, yeah, and they manifest in the physical world, they must be connected. What's the inner connection between eating, speaking, and kissing? And the answer is they are all functions of connection. Eating is the means of connecting the soul where the body holds it in. Speaking is always the level of connecting. When I speak, I connect with what's in me with what's in you, right? Speech is always the connection. It's actually not only the connection between people, speech is the connection with the higher world and the lower world. The word the root Hebrew root dibur, dabar, speaking, the only one aspect of that root means speaking with the mouth. The general concept of dibur means to take a plan or a concept and connect it into the world of expression. That's called dabar. Dabar echad lador means a leader of a generation. Yadber amim tachtenu means one nation controlling another, yeah, dominion. It means a controlling dimension manifesting its control in the expressed world. Speech is only one version of that connection. And that's why you speak with your mouth. Of course, that's why the voice is produced in the neck. We've put it as many times. The neck is the organ of connection between the higher world of the head and the lower world of the body. That's why speech, right, is formed in the throat, which is that zone of connection between the higher. Why do you have a neck? Why do you have a neck?
Can I walk around like this?
Why do you have a neck? The neck is that interesting zone of connection between the differential world of the higher and the lower. That's why fish have no neck. And that's why fish do not need shechita. Why do fish not need to be shechted? Shechting an animal to make it kosher is done by a certain operation on the neck. It's a very special spiritual tikkun, connection, yeah, correction. Is done by a particular kind of separation of higher and lower. Very, very deep issue. Fish come from a different world. The fish did not die in the flood. The fish weren't destroyed. They were not contaminated by man. Fish is a completely different thing. The halacha is, in order to shech the fish, all you need to do is take it out of the water. You're not allowed to eat a fish in the water. Yeah, it has to be taken out. But it's not allowed, but it doesn't need shechting, not like a animal that has a neck. Did you ever wonder why fish don't have necks? And animals do? Doesn't take the world at face value. You have to ask these questions. So the mouth is the organ of eating, which is connection. Speech, which is the world of connection of higher world. And kissing, in the higher world, the tongue is called a circumcision, a bris. I can't go into too much detail here. But the tongue, the mouth, is the organ of connection. That's why, yeah, just like speech between people is the connection between them on a spiritual level, kissing, a kiss, is a natural expression of intimacy and bond, right? In many societies, men kiss each other in Torah, in the ancient Torah, in Torah sources, of course, that was also expression of, it's a natural expression of affection, parent for a child. Why are human beings built in such a way that to express closeness and affection they kiss each other? Why? It's bizarre. Bizarre. The reason you don't think it's bizarre is because you were brought up that way. The first thing you knew, your mother was infecting you with her germs, right? So you sort of grew up in that, so you don't think it's bizarre. But objectively, it's bizarre. If you came from Mars and I said to you, look, these things are called humans. Devise for me a method of intimate, expression of intimacy that really shows the closeness. What you would have thought of kissing? It's bizarre. It's unhealthy. I mean, it's risky. I mean, it's grotesque. It's absurd. But this is the concept. The mouth in the higher world, incidentally, again, I can't go into detail, but real intimacy is always these three areas. Whenever the Torah or the Gemara wants to talk about marital connection in its clean and beautiful way, it talks about eating or kissing. Right? After midnight, the Gemara says, Isha Mesaperes Imbaila, a woman speaks to her husband, it used the word speaking. Ra'ua Medaberes, they saw her speaking to a man. Yeah, many examples like this. Achla Machsapia, she ate and wiped her mouth and said, Lo Palti, I never did anything wrong. Many times you've found in the Torah the images of either eating or speaking when the concept is that kind of connection. Again, that is because you're talking about connection. Again, you're talking about the ultimate connection, male-female connection. So far, so good? Clear? Yeah? That's eating. Let's turn our attention for a moment to sacrifices. The idea of a korban is the idea of the world eating. Again, when you eat, what happens is you take energy, you take food from the external world, you incorporate in yourself, and that maintains the connection to your neshama stays in your body. Your body and your soul are only a microcosmic projection of the world. What you called olam katan, you are a small version of the world. But the world at large, right, is a body. And the world is invested with a neshama, that's called the shechina, Hashem's presence. And it takes food, it takes energy to keep that spiritual being in that cosmic body. And that food is called the sacrifices. That's why we talk about all the laws of sacrifices are all given expression of food and meals. Es korbani lachmi, Hashem says, my sacrifice is my bread. The altar, the mizbech, is called shulchan gavua, the higher table. All the sacrifices have to be accompanied with salt, like a meal. All the laws and practices of the korban, of the sacrifices, are the concept, as it were. And what happens when the world doesn't eat? What happens when we cannot do that? When the world, as it were, cannot be fed? The spiritual entity of the world distracts itself from the world. That's why we look, that's why we're in the mess that we're in. Today, we don't have any ability. We can't do that. We can't, as it were, feed the mouth of the world, right? The Nefesh HaChaim says this amazing idea. And that's, of course, why we have no spiritual presence in the world. Today, we do it only by alternative means. Neshalma parim svasenu, that we have to, the tefillot, the prayers that we, with the mouth, again, no accident here, of course. The prayers that we utter is another version of it's a replacement for the sacrifices, but it's nothing compared to, incidentally, of course, you shouldn't miss the point, I'm sure you're already thinking ahead of me. Where are sacrifices brought? In the temple. The Beis HaMikdash, right? The Beis HaMikdash has three functions: eating, kissing, and speaking. Eating, namely, that's where the sacrifices are brought and burned and offered up with all the aspects of meals. The speaking takes place there, doesn't it? Where's Hashem's voice heard? From between the two golden kruvim, between the two golden angels, right? In the Kodesh Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies, that's where the speaking of the world takes place. And of course, that's where the ultimate kiss is. The temple is called the place, the Shmaya V'ara Nashki Adadi, where heaven and earth kiss. Because it means the lower world's connection with the spiritual world. That is the focus of connection. And of course, that's why, again, we can't go into detail, but the two golden angels on top of the Aron were male and female. Ne'urim zebezeh, it says, embraced, embracing each other. And of course, those angels, that the angelic embrace, is really the symbol, as it were, for his relationship with us. That's why the Gemara says that when our relationship with him is perfect, they are embracing each other. And yet when our relationship with him is distant, they face away. Right? That's the symbol of these two angels, miraculously, although they're cast in one piece with the gold that they stand on. Nevertheless, they face away and face towards. Famous mystery is the question of why, when the Romans destroyed the temple, were they embracing? Surely when the temple's destroyed is the greatest time of greatest distance between us. They should have been facing completely away. And yet at that moment they were embracing. And again, there's many, many deep meanings there. But one simple meaning is that when in our intimate personal relationship with him, they face away. But when the Romans are in, and these things are paraded in the streets, in relationship, in terms of his relationship with us as opposed to other nations, that's called intimacy. The fact that we may be undergoing punishment and suffering, but it's only as a manifestation of his concern and his attachment to us, right? Worth being corrected. Yeah, discussion. But this is the concept of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore sacrifices are seen in this way is the function of the world's eating. Let's spend a moment talking about vegetarianism and the killing of animals. Is that in a primary sense this is not a good thing, right? Killing an animal and eating it is not good. The sources indicate that it's, as it were, a secondary system. The world is created primarily to be vegetarian. On the contrary, not only that, animals won't eat each other either in the Messianic Age. In the Messianic Age, right? In the final version of that, animals, we have verses, explicit verses, they will not eat each other, and let alone I'll eat them. Right? One creature sustaining itself by the death, the brutal death of another, is not the way the world is designed. How did that come to be? Again, Rav Wasserman used to explain like this, very briefly, is that the primary system in the world is that people ate animal, plant material. But because the sin of the flood generation was primarily what's called chamas, that means stealing from each other in various ways, the concession, that means the reformed world after the flood, bore the scar of that sin. What is the essence of stealing? That I live, I sustain myself by that which is yours. Right? Which is ultimately not just yours, but you. A tzaddik who owns his property, owns it with his life. Because he spent his life earning the money that bought those goods, or spent his life manufacturing those things. When I take goods from you, stealing from a tzaddik, you're actually taking, if he spent a year manufacturing something, and you steal that object from him, in a sense you're taking away a translated value of that year of his life. And therefore, the symbol of that, if you like, or the consequence is, that the reformed world, after the flood, we are now reduced to the humiliation that we sustain our lives by taking that which is the essence or the life of another creature. It is humiliating and it's not ideal. Far from ideal. The humiliation is that we're designed that way. And physiologically, our bodies are designed to eat meat. You can live a vegetarian life in a healthy way, but you have to be very careful. You have to know what you're doing. Because no plant material has all the essential elements of proteins that you need. So in order to put together a comprehensive protein diet by vegetarian, you have to be very careful to know what you're doing. You have to combine enough different protein sources to build what you call first-class protein. You only have second-class, so-called second-class protein in plant material. So you have to, apart from iron deficiency and various other problems. But it's a secondary system which is not ideal. Rav Wasserman used to say that's why meat, unlike plant material, leaves an aftertaste. You know that no plants leave an aftertaste. Plant material leaves no aftertaste. Don't ask me about garlic and about onions. Don't ask me about that. Okay, first of all, if you eat raw onions, that's your own problem. If onions are cooked, they're sweet. I don't know. But food that is represents taking the life of a creature like fish and meat is tasty while you eat it, but leaves an aftertaste. The notion of dessert, actually, in the Hebrew concept, is a kinuach, a taste chaser. It is a sweetness to take away. Rav Wasserman used to say eating meat is like a sin. It's nice while you're doing it, and it leaves you feeling problematic afterwards. That's a very deep idea. But that's a concession to human nature. It's not ideal. What is the justification? So there's a very deep idea, again from Kabbalistic and particularly Hasidic sources, I'll just mention it briefly, is that the tikkun here is that when you eat meat, you elevate. Let's just get this clear. It's a very important idea. And of course, this is the essence of sacrifices, is bringing them up or bringing them close. But the concept is that when you eat meat, you elevate that animal into your own being. And the animal at plant is elevated into it. And the plant lived off the organic and inorganic world, the chemical world, what's called domem. That means the domem is the inanimate, I guess, world. So it's absorbed in. Again, there's a chain here. You have to appreciate this. Plants are eating the chemical world. the inorganic, the inanimate world. Animals eat the plants. When you eat an animal, you incorporate the whole chain into the spiritual level. That's a tremendous elevation. You have to understand this very, very deep idea. If you eat an animal, you are ending a process of absorbing the whole world into the self. That's why it's critical, if you eat animals, to live a spiritual life. Because if you kill an animal, you take its life so that you live. What do you do with that? So if you eat an animal, you eat meat, eat a chicken, and then you spend the rest of the day based on the sustenance and the nourishment of that chicken doing mitzvahs, nothing better could ever happen to a chicken. Every chicken dovens, right? You have to understand this. Every chicken prays fervently to be eaten by a tzaddik. Because what then happens is his material animal existence is translated into the spiritual force of mitzvahs. That is an amazing elevation for a chicken. And every chicken's worst nightmare is that he'll be eaten by a negative individual or a person who's just going to eat him and go to sleep. Or worse, someone is going to eat him and practice negativity in the world. Because then he's been translated into sins, into spiritual damage. Is this clear? And therefore, that's why it says a wise person should eat meat. Yet what you're doing is, if you allow yourself to do that, you're incorporating the whole chain into the level of human spirituality. Nothing better, could be nothing better in the world. That is the ultimate correction and having. But if you eat it and don't do that, so then you've taken the life of a creature. And there's nobody cannot be sensitive to that. When you eat meat and you actually see the parts. Rav Wasserman used to say, talking about a great tzaddik when he was 90 years old. He used to say that, how can you not be sensitive? You eat an animal, you eat a chicken, and you see the parts, what you're eating them. It's, you have to be, how spiritual you are. On contrary, the more spiritual you are, you feel that the Torah allows it, and it does special tikkun, and a special elevation, and it has to be done in a certain way, and the laws of kashrut, and so forth. But it's not a primary system. Technically, is it allowed to be vegetarian, to be a practicing Jew, and keep mitzvot, and be vegetarian? Is it allowed? The answer is, it's allowed, yes, it's allowed. You may not say that eating meat is wrong. If the Torah allows it, it's beseder, right? And you can't say that it's cruel. You can't say it's cruel. That doesn't mean animals don't suffer at all when they're shechted. It doesn't mean that. But the Torah allows it. Right? As it happens, they suffer remarkably little. I mean, in any physiological demonstrations that have been done, I mean, you know that it's a very big anti-Semitic point of, you know this. In some countries, at least one European country where shechit is not allowed. You know that. Do you know that on the basis of cruelty? On the basis of cruelty. Talking about nations that butcher Jews, right, in a way that they've never done to cockroaches, who outlaw shechita because it's cruel. Do you understand what's going on? There's at least one country today in which it's illegal. And many others have many times attempted to show that the Jewish method of shechting animals, that is cruel. The Torah has a prohibition of cruelty to animals, and the method of shechita has to be so immaculate, so impeccably perfect. The knife has to be so sharp. Yeah, I mean, this. It's very interesting. You know, there was a physiology, there was an attempt. They tried to demonstrate, some scientific work was done to try to demonstrate that after an animal is shechted, the blood pressure in the brain remains enough for a few seconds that the animal could have still sensation. And we understand that if the animal is shechted and the blood pressure, because of the cutting of the major vessels, drops the cerebral blood pressure instantaneously, so then there's instantaneous unconsciousness. Yeah. But if the blood pressure is maintained even for a couple of seconds, so there could be a couple of seconds during which the animal might feel something. So, of course, you can demonstrate very elegantly that by cutting the major vessels, there's absolutely completely instantaneous fall, right, to zero blood pressure. And then somebody showed that this is not correct. Why? Because you have a vertebrobasilar system. You have a vertebral arteries that supply the brain, which communicate with the vessels that supply the brain from the carotid system. And therefore, there's enough blood flow to the brain from the vertebral arteries to keep the blood pressure up long enough that the animal should feel something. So this was taken seriously, and they did investigate. They found an amazing thing. All kosher animals lack vertebral arteries. Do you know that? Unkosher animals have a thing like that. But kosher animals don't have them. Remarkable, interesting thing. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The point is that this is a very special process, and that is thing. That, if the Torah allows it, is spiritual, and it's a mitzvah, and it's fine. If you feel that you personally can't eat meat because you feel sensitive, or because it makes you feel unhealthy or heavy, or etc., and you personally, there's no. It's true that there's a mitzvah to eat meat on Chagim, on Yontov, because meat and wine is considered to be a man's a physical way of simcha, that means eating meat and wine at the meals on a chag, on a Yom Tov, is ein simcha ela b'basar b'yayin. Yeah. So that is obviously only applies to a person who feels pleasure, right? You're doing this because it adds to the simcha of the Yom Tov, right? But if you're the kind of person who eats meat and feels sick eating it, you're not just like a person who drinks wine and gets a headache. That is not fulfilling the mitzvah, obviously, of simcha. Not for women, incidentally. A woman's joy is supposed to be new clothes, and that's why it's a husband's obligation to buy his wife a new outfit on every Yom Tov. That's your obligation. Anyway, that's what it is. So, eating meat, this is the concept of meat. So, in summary, what do we learn this evening? We learned that eating meat is a tremendous elevation. It's a tremendous elevation for the whole chain, provided that it is an elevation. That means that it's incorporated into, that the lowest elements of the world are elevated through this chain and incorporated into correct act. Incidentally, you know that the Jewish intention in eating should be to use the food. Again, when you eat, not only are you absorbing parts of the physical world, but you're also enjoying the pleasure of eating. Right? And the concept is, what are you engaging physicality in such a dangerous way for? You're incorporating the physical world into yourself, and it's pleasurable too. How does that make you spiritual as dangerous? And the concept is, every Jew, when you eat, the intention should be that you're eating and enjoying the food in order to use the pleasure and the nourishment to serve Hashem. That's the idea. You're not supposed to not enjoy it. Let's get this clear. The concept of prishut, right, what we call precious, which means separation from physicality. You know, if you have a problem here, if you read any work of Jewish character building, Musa, you'll find that on the one hand, the Jewish path is to engage physicality. We do drink wine, we eat meals on Shabbat and so forth, we enjoy that, we get married, we don't become celibates and ascetics, we engage the physical world. On the other hand, the same books have a chapter called Prishut, which means ascetic transcendence, yeah, not engaging the world. How do you put those together? But the answer is very clear. The Jewish path is, you are allowed to engage the world. You're obliged to engage the world. You have to enjoy the world, but not for its own sake. Only for the sake of the purpose of the elevation. Again, if you eat food because you enjoy eating food, that is not a spiritual thing to do, and that will bring you down and make you physical. But if you eat food because the food and the pleasure of the food is used as a tool that you go out and do what you have to do in the world, then you become spiritual and you elevate the physical world. But the Ramchal says that plainly. And that's one of the deepest Hasidic ideas, is that the purpose of life is not to be spiritual. It's to spiritualize the physical. It's very easy to sit on a mountaintop and not drink wine and not get married and not engage the world and transcend. Right? It's a valid pathway in certain circumstances. But the Jewish path is not that. The Jewish path is engaging the world and schlepping the world up to spirituality. Right? It's being able to get married and drink wine and eat food and bring that up to spirituality. That's our path, much more difficult. And that's what a Jew is obliged to do. And therefore, the concept of eating in general, let alone not only meat, the concept of eating in general, or enjoying any physicality in the world, is not to be dangerously drawn down into the physical, but in a courageous and self-controlled way to elevate the physical to the spiritual level. That's why you do it. And food is one of the most potent examples of that, because you aren't only doing the activity for spiritual, it's actually elevating, actually transforming, transmuting the physical material into the spiritual dimension. So in summary, the concept is that eating is one of the forms of connection with the lower, between lower and higher world. That's why the mitzvah, many, many mitzvahs go around eating. And the concept is that it is, that's the form of connection. The laws of kashrut, of kosher food, are the particular correct governance of this area. Engaging food wrongly is a contaminating effect. That's why it says unkosher food is metamtem es halev. It decontaminates and desensitizes the Jewish heart. That's why we don't eat. Yeah, that's eating of unkosher food is not only a disobedience to a divine command, like all transgressions are, but here you're incorporating into your being a desensitizing element, and that's why many foods, for example, predator animals that eat each other. Right? We don't eat carnivorous animals. They have a certain spiritual quality that is incorporated into you. Even certain birds that are rapacious, or that eat each other, or that are manifest certain traits in their behavior, even though there's not a question of any free will here. But those characteristics, yeah, you are what you eat in a deep sense, as we know. And therefore the spiritual qualities of these foods are, and that's also why it says that Hashem protects a tzaddik from inadvertently eating anything wrong. You know that? If a person's on a spiritual level, he's guaranteed that he won't accidentally eat anything that's wrong when he makes the right effort. When you make the right effort, sometimes a mistake could occur. Why does Hashem protect the tzaddik in that area, not in other areas? Because food becomes you. And therefore there's a special indignity and a special contamination in eating food that is inappropriate. Of course, there's no excuse today. I mean, it's today, in a place like this, you can get anything you want, kosher and better, and there's no excuse for... The only excuse for contaminating your soul is that you must have done it so frequently till now that you've got no sensitivity left, and it's time to make a change. And therefore, this is the concept of handling food correctly. It's a spiritualizing influence, it is spiritualizing you, spiritualizing the physical substance. This is the approach to sacrifices, which is nothing less than the world, as it were, eating, making its connection with the spiritual world. And this is the concept of eating meat, which is that particularly problematic area of utilizing the life of another living being, not which once was on a human level, not in that particularly sensitive way, which is very problematic. This is a concession that has been allowed after the flood. In the messianic age, it will not be the case again. We will not need to eat, take the life of other beings, right, and spill blood, as it were, of other life force of other creatures, other beings. That is the concept. So the practical message, if you need one out of this, is, of course, the theoretical message for today, of course, is the refocus on the concept of korbanah sacrifices, which is the sublimation of the self in bringing that animal close, the elevation of the self in that act. Very hard for us to understand, but there's a beginning of understanding. And, of course, the laws of correctly eating. And finally, not only the laws of correct eating, but the right attitude, right? One should eat with the attitude that this food is being used as material for spiritual elevation. I will stop there for today. Sure.